the address Ulrich had given him. It was a two-story building that looked like a Lutheran chapel. A notice outside said the Workers' Friend Club and Institute was open to all working men regardless of politics, but another notice betrayed the nature of the place by announcing that it had been opened in 1906 by Peter Kropotkin. Felix wondered whether he would meet the legendary Kropotkin here in London. He went in. He saw in the lobby a pile of newspapers, also called The Worker's Friend, but in Yiddish, Der Arbeiter Freund. Notices on the walls advertised lessons in English, a Sunday school, a trip to Epping Forest, and a lecture on Hamlet. Felix stepped into the hall. The architecture confirmed his earlier instinct. This had definitely been the nave of a nonconformist church once upon a time. However, it had been transformed by the addition of a stage at one end and a bar at the other. On the stage, a group of men and women appeared to be rehearsing a play. Perhaps this was what anarchists did in England, Felix thought. That would explain why they were allowed to have clubs. He went over to the bar. There was no sign of alcoholic drink, but on the counter he saw gefilte fish, pickled herring, and, joy, a samovar. The girl behind the counter looked at him and said, "New?" Felix smiled. A week later, on the day that Prince Orlov was due to arrive in London, Felix had lunch at a French restaurant in Soho. He arrived early and picked a table near the door. He ate onion soup, filet steak, and goat's cheese, and drank half a bottle of red wine. He ordered in French. The waiters were deferential. When he finished, it was the height of the lunch hour rush. At a moment when three of the waiters were in the kitchen and the other two had their backs to him, he calmly got up, went to the door, took his coat and hat, and left without paying. He smiled as he walked down the street. He enjoyed stealing. He had quickly learned how to live in this town on almost no money. For breakfast, he would buy sweet tea and a slab of bread from a street store for tuppence, but that was the only food he would pay for. At lunchtime, he stole fruit or vegetables from street stalls. In the evening, he would go to a charity soup kitchen and get a bowl of broth and unlimited bread in return for listening to an incomprehensible sermon and singing a hymn. He had £5 in cash, but it was for emergencies. He was living at Dunstan Houses in Stepney Green, in a five-story tenement building where lived half the leading anarchists in London. He had a mattress on the floor in the apartment of Rudolf Rocker, the charismatic blonde German who edited Der Arbeiter Freund. Rocker's charisma did not work on Felix, who was immune to charm, but Felix respected the man's total dedication. Rocker and his wife Millie kept open house for anarchists, and all day and half the night there were visitors, messengers, debates, committee meetings, and endless tea and cigarettes. Felix paid no rent, but each day he brought home something, a pound of sausages, a packet of tea, a pocketful of oranges, for the communal larder. They thought he bought these things, but of course he stole them. He told the other anarchists he was here to study at the British Museum and finish his book about natural anarchism in primitive communities. They believed him. They were friendly, dedicated, and harmless. They sincerely believed the revolution could be brought about by education and trade unionism, by pamphlets and lectures and trips to Epping Forest. Felix knew that most anarchists outside Russia were like this. He did not hate them, but secretly he despised them, for in the end they were just frightened. Nevertheless, among such groups there were generally a few violent men. When he needed them, he would seek them out. Meanwhile, he worried about whether Orlov would come and about how he would kill him. Such worries were useless, and he tried to distract his mind by working on his English. He had learned a little of the language in cosmopolitan Switzerland. During the long train journey across Europe, he had studied a school textbook for Russian children and an English translation of his favorite novel, The Captain's Daughter by Pushkin, which he knew almost by heart in Russian. Now he read the Times every morning in the reading room of the Jubilee Street Club, and in the afternoons he walked the streets, striking up conversations with drunks, vagrants, and prostitutes, the people he liked best, the people who broke the rules. The printed words in books soon meshed with the sounds all around him, and already he could say anything he needed to. Before long he would be able to talk politics in English. After leaving the restaurant, he walked north across Oxford Street and entered the German Quarter west of Tottenham Court Road. There were a lot of revolutionists among the Germans, but they tended to be communists rather than anarchists. Felix admired the discipline of the communists, but he was suspicious of their authoritarianism, and besides, he was temperamentally unsuited to party work. He walked all the way across Regent's Park and entered the middle-class suburb to its north. He wandered around the tree-lined streets, looking into the small gardens of the neat brick villas, searching for a bicycle to steal. He had learned to ride a bicycle in Switzerland, and had discovered that it was the perfect vehicle for shadowing someone, for it was manoeuvrable and inconspicuous, and in city traffic it was fast enough to keep up with a motor car or a carriage. Sadly, the bourgeois citizens of this part of London seemed to keep their bicycles locked away. He saw one cycle being ridden along the street, and was tempted to knock the rider off the machine, but at that moment there were three pedestrians and a baker's van in the road, and Felix did not want to create a scene. A little later he saw a boy delivering groceries, but the boy's cycle was too conspicuous, with a large basket on the front and a metal plate hanging from the crossbar bearing the name of the grocer. Felix was beginning to toy with alternative strategies when at last he saw what he needed. A man of about 30 came out of one of the gardens wheeling a bicycle. The man wore a straw boater and a striped blazer which bulged over his paunch. He leaned his cycle against the garden wall and bent down to put on his trouser clips. Felix approached him rapidly. The man saw his shadow, looked up and muttered, "Good afternoon." Felix knocked him down. The man rolled on his back and looked up at Felix with a stupid expression of surprise. Felix fell on him, dropping one knee into the middle button of the striped blazer. The man's breath left his body in a whoosh, and he was winded, helpless, gasping for air. Felix stood up and glanced toward the house. A young woman stood at a window watching, her hand raised to her open mouth, her eyes wide with fright. He looked again at the man on the ground. It would be a minute or so before he even thought about getting up. Felix climbed on the bicycle and rode away rapidly. "A man who has no fear can do anything he wants," Felix thought. He had learned that lesson 11 years ago in a railway siding outside Omsk. It had been snowing. It was snowing. Felix sat in an open railway truck on a pile of coal, freezing to death. He had been cold for a year, ever since he escaped from the chain gang in the gold mine. In that year, he had crossed Siberia from the frozen north almost to the Urals. Now he was a mere 1,000 miles from civilization and warm weather. Most of the way he had walked, although sometimes he rode in rail cars or on wagons full of pelts. He preferred to ride with cattle, for they kept him warm, and he could share their feed. He was vaguely aware that he was little more than an animal himself. He never washed. His coat was a blanket stolen from a horse. His ragged clothes were full of lice, and there were fleas in his hair. His favorite food was raw birds' eggs. Once he had stolen a pony, ridden it to death, then eaten its liver. He had lost his sense of time. He knew it was autumn by the weather, but he did not know what month he was in. Often he found himself unable to remember what he had done the day before. In his saner moments, he realized he was half mad. He never spoke to people. When he came to a town or village, he skirted it, pausing only to rob the garbage dump. He knew only that he had to keep going west, for it would be warmer there. But the coal train had been shunted onto a siding, and Felix thought he might be dying. There was a guard, a burly policeman in a fur coat, who was there to stop peasants from taking coal for their fires. As that thought occurred to him, Felix realized he was having a lucid moment, and that it might be his last. He wondered what had brought it on. Then he smelled the policeman's dinner. But the policeman was big and healthy and had a gun. "I don't care," Felix thought. "I'm dying anyway." So he stood up and picked up the biggest lump of coal he could carry and staggered over to the policeman's hut and went in and hit the startled policeman over the head with the lump of coal. There was a pot on the fire and stew in the pot, too hot to eat. Felix carried the pot outside and emptied it out into the snow. Then he fell on his knees and ate the food mixed with cooling snow. There were lumps of potato and turnip and fat carrots and chunks of meat. He swallowed them whole. The policeman came out of the hut and hit Felix with his club, a heavy blow across the back. Felix was wild with rage that the man should try to stop him from eating. He got up from the ground and flew at the man, kicking and scratching. The policeman fought back with his club, but Felix could not feel the blows. He got his fingers on the man's throat and squeezed. He would not let go. After a while the man's eyes closed, then his face went blue, then his tongue came out. Then Felix finished the stew. He ate all the food in the hut and warmed himself by the fire, and slept in the policeman's bed. When he woke up, he was sane. He took the boots and the coat off the corpse and walked to Omsk. On the way, he made a remarkable discovery about himself. He had lost the ability to feel fear. Something had happened in his mind, as if a switch had closed. He could think of nothing that could possibly frighten him. If hungry, he would steal. If chased, he would hide. If threatened, he would kill. There was nothing he wanted. Nothing could hurt him any more. Love, pride, desire, and compassion were forgotten emotions. They all came back eventually, except the fear. When he reached Omsk, he sold the policeman's fur coat and bought trousers and a shirt, a waistcoat, and a topcoat. He burned his rags and paid 1 ruble for a hot bath and a shave in a cheap hotel. He ate in a restaurant using a knife instead of his fingers. He saw the front page of a newspaper and remembered how to read, and then he knew he had come back from the grave. He sat on a bench in Liverpool Street Station, his bicycle leaning against the wall beside him. He wondered what Orlov was like. He knew nothing about the man other than his rank and mission. The prince might be a dull, plodding, loyal servant of the Tsar, or a sadist and a lecher, or a kindly, white-haired old man who liked nothing better than to bounce his grandchildren on his knee. It did not matter. Felix would kill him anyway. He was confident he would recognize Orlov, for Russians of that type had not the faintest conception of travelling unobtrusively, secret mission or no. Would Orlov come? If he did come and arrived on the very train Joseph had specified, and if he subsequently met with the Earl of Walden, as Joseph had said he would, then there could hardly be any further doubt that Joseph's information had been accurate. A few minutes before the train was due, a closed coach, drawn by 4 magnificent horses, clattered by and drove straight onto the platform. There was a coachman in front, and a liveried footman hanging on behind. A railwayman, in a military-style coat with shiny buttons, strode after the coach. The railwayman spoke to the coachman and directed him to the far end of the platform. Then a station-master in a frock coat and top hat arrived, looking important, consulting his fob watch, and comparing it critically with the station clocks. He opened the carriage door for the passenger to step down. The railwayman walked past Felix's bench, and Felix grabbed his sleeve. "Please, sir," he said, putting on a wide-eyed expression of a naive foreign tourist. "Is that the King of England?" The railwayman grinned. "No, mate, it's only the Earl of Walden." He walked on. So Joseph had been right. Felix studied Walden with an assassin's eye. He was tall, about Felix's height, and beefy, easier to shoot than a small man. He was about 50. Except for a slight limp, he seemed fit. He could run away, but not very fast. He wore a highly visible light grey morning coat and a top hat of the same colour. His hair under the hat was short and straight, and he had a spade-shaped beard patterned after that of the late King Edward VII. He stood on the platform, leaning on a cane, potential weapon, and favouring his left leg. The coachman, the footman, and the station-master bustled about him like bees around the Queen. His stance was relaxed. He did not look at his watch. He paid no attention to the flunkies around him. "He is used to this," Felix thought. "All his life he has been the important man in the crowd." The train appeared, smoke billowing from the funnel of the engine. "I could kill Orlov now," Felix thought, and he felt momentarily the thrill of the hunter as he closes with his prey. But he had already decided not to do the deed today. He was here to observe, not to act. Most anarchist assassinations were bungled because of haste or spontaneity, in his view. He believed in planning and organization, which were anathema to many anarchists, but they did not realize that a man could plan his own actions. It was when he began to organize the lives of others that he became a tyrant. The train halted with a great sigh of steam. Felix stood up and moved a little closer to the platform. Toward the far end of the train was what appeared to be a private car, differentiated from the rest by the colors of its bright new paintwork. It came to a stop precisely opposite Walden's coach. The station-master stepped forward eagerly and opened a door. Felix tensed, peering along the platform, watching the shadowed space in which his quarry would appear. For a moment everyone waited. Then Orlov was there. He paused in the doorway for a second, and in that time Felix's eye photographed him. He was a small man, wearing an expensive-looking heavy Russian coat, with a fur collar and a black top hat. His face was pink and youthful, almost boyish, with a small moustache and no beard. He smiled hesitantly. He looked vulnerable, Felix thought. So much evil is done by people with innocent faces. Orlov stepped off the train. He and Walden embraced, Russian fashion, but quickly. Then they got into the coach. That was rather hasty, Felix thought. The footman and two porters began to load luggage onto the carriage. It rapidly became clear that they could not get everything on, and Felix smiled to think of his own cardboard suitcase half empty. The coach was turned around. It seemed the footman was being left behind to take care of the rest of the luggage. The porters came to the carriage window, and a grey-sleeved arm emerged and dropped coins into their hands. The coach pulled away. Felix mounted his bicycle and followed. In the tumult of the London traffic, it was not difficult for him to keep pace. He trailed them through the city, along the Strand, and across St. James's Park. On the far side of the park, the coach followed the boundary road for a few yards, then turned abruptly into a walled forecourt. Felix jumped off his bicycle and wheeled it along the grass at the edge of the park until he stood across the road from the gateway. He could see the coach drawn up at the imposing entrance to a large house. Over the roof of the coach he saw two top hats, one black and one grey, disappear into the building. Then the door closed and he could see no more. Lydia studied her daughter critically. Charlotte stood in front of a large pier glass, trying on the debutante's gown she would wear to be presented at court. Madame Bourdon, the thin, elegant dressmaker, fussed about her with pins, tucking a flounce here and fastening a ruffle there. Charlotte looked both beautiful and innocent, just the effect that was called for in a debutante. The dress of white tulle, embroidered with crystals, went down almost to the floor and partly covered the tiny pointed shoes. Its neckline, plunging to waist level, was filled in with a crystal corsage. The train was 4 yards of cloth of silver lined with pale pink chiffon and caught at the end by a huge white and silver bow. Charlotte's dark hair was piled high and fastened with a tiara, which had belonged to the previous Lady Walden, Stephen's mother. In her hair she wore the regulation 2 white plumes. "My baby is almost grown up," Lydia thought. She said, "It's very lovely, Madame Bourdon." "Thank you, my lady," Charlotte said. "It's terribly uncomfortable." Lydia sighed. It was just the kind of thing Charlotte would say. Lydia said, "I wish you wouldn't be so frivolous." Charlotte knelt down to pick up her train. Lydia said, "You don't have to kneel. Look, copy me and I'll show you how it's done. Turn to the left." Charlotte did so and the train draped down her left side. "Gather up with your left arm, then make another quarter turn to the left." Now the train stretched out along the floor in front of Charlotte. "Walk forward, using your right hand to loop the train over your left arm as you go." "It works." Charlotte smiled. When she smiled, you could feel the glow. She used to be like this all the time, Lydia thought, when she was little. I always knew what was going on in her mind. Growing up is learning to deceive. Charlotte said, "Who taught you all these things, Mama?" "Your Uncle George's first wife, Belinda's mother, coached me before I was presented." She wanted to say, "These things are easy to teach, but the hard lessons you must learn on your own." Charlotte's governess, Maria, came into the room. She was an efficient, unsentimental woman in an iron-grey dress, the only servant Lydia had brought from St. Petersburg. Her appearance had not changed in 19 years. Lydia had no idea how old she was. 50, 60. Maria said, "Prince Orlov has arrived, my lady." "Why, Charlotte, you look magnificent." It was almost time for Maria to begin calling her Lady Charlotte, Lydia thought. She said, "Come down as soon as you've changed, Charlotte." Charlotte immediately began to unfasten the shoulder straps which held her train. Lydia went out. She found Stephen in the drawing-room, sipping sherry. He touched her bare arm and said, "I love to see you in summer dresses." She smiled. "Thank you." He looked rather fine himself, she thought, in his grey coat and silver tie. There was more grey and silver in his beard. "We might have been so happy, you and I." Suddenly she wanted to kiss his cheek. She glanced around the room. There was a footman at the sideboard pouring sherry. She had to restrain the impulse. She sat down and accepted a glass from the footman. "How is Alex?"
"Much the same as always," Stephen replied. "You'll see, he'll be down in a minute. What about Charlotte's dress?"
"The gown is lovely. It's her attitude that disturbs me. She's unwilling to take anything at face value these days. I should hate her to become cynical."
Stephen refused to worry about that.
"You wait until some handsome guards officer starts paying attention to her. She'll soon change her mind."
The remark irritated Lydia, implying as it did that all girls were the slaves of their romantic natures. It was the kind of thing Stephen said when he did not want to think about a subject. It made him sound like a hearty, empty-headed country squire, which he was not. But he was convinced that Charlotte was no different from any other 18-year-old, and he would not hear otherwise. Lydia knew that Charlotte had in her make-up a streak of something wild and un-English, which had to be suppressed. Irrationally, Lydia felt hostile toward Alex on account of Charlotte. It was not his fault, but he represented the St. Petersburg factor, the danger of the past. She shifted restlessly in her chair and caught Stephen observing her with a shrewd eye. He said,
"You can't possibly be nervous about meeting little Alex."
She shrugged. "Russians are so unpredictable."
"He's not very Russian."
She smiled at her husband, but their moment of intimacy had passed, and now there was just the usual qualified affection in her heart. The door opened. "Be calm," Lydia told herself.
Alex came in. "Aunt Lydia," he said, and bowed over her hand.
"How do you do, Alexei Andreevich?" she said formally. Then she softened her tone and added, "Why, you still look 18.
"I wish I were,"
he said, and his eyes twinkled. She asked him about his trip. As he replied, she found herself wondering why he was still unmarried. He had a title, which on its own was enough to knock many girls, not to mention their mothers, off their feet. And on top of that, he was strikingly good-looking and enormously rich. "I'm sure he's broken a few hearts," she thought. "Your brothers and your sister send their love," Alex was saying,
"and ask for your prayers."
He frowned.
"St. Petersburg is very unsettled now. It's not the town you knew."
Stephen said,
"We've heard about this monk, Rasputin. The Tsarina believes that God speaks through him, and she has great influence over the Tsar. But Rasputin is only a symptom. All the time there are strikes and sometimes riots. The people no longer believe that the Tsar is holy."
"What is to be done?" Stephen asked. Alex sighed.
"Everything. We need efficient farms, more factories, a proper parliament like England's, land reform, trade unions, freedom of speech."
"I shouldn't be in too much of a hurry to have trade unions if I were you," Stephen said.
"Perhaps. Still, somehow Russia must join the 20th century. Either we, the nobility, must do it, or the people will destroy us and do it themselves."
Lydia thought he sounded more radical than the radicals. How things must have changed at home, that a prince could talk like this. Her sister, Tatiana, Alex's mother, referred in her letters to the Troubles, but gave no hint that the nobility was in real danger. But then Alex was more like his father, the old Prince Orlov, a political animal. If he were alive today, he would talk like this. Stephen said,
"There is a third possibility, you know, a way in which the aristocracy and the people might yet be united."
Alex smiled as if he knew what was coming.
"And that is?" "A war."
Alex nodded gravely. They think alike, Lydia reflected. Alex always looked up to Stephen. Stephen was the nearest thing to a father that the boy had, after the old prince died. Charlotte came in, and Lydia stared at her in surprise. She was wearing a frock Lydia had never seen, of cream lace lined with chocolate brown silk. Lydia would never have chosen it. It was rather striking, but there was no denying that Charlotte looked ravishing.
"Where did she buy it?" Lydia wondered. "When did she start buying clothes without taking me along? Who told her that those colours flatter her dark hair and brown eyes? Does she have a trace of makeup on? And why isn't she wearing a corset?"
Stephen was also staring. Lydia noticed that he had stood up, and she almost laughed. It was a dramatic acknowledgement of his daughter's grown-up status, and what was funny was that it was clearly involuntary. In a moment he would feel foolish, and he would realize that standing up every time his daughter walked into a room
was a courtesy he could hardly sustain in his own house. The effect on Alex was even greater. He sprang to his feet, spilled his sherry, and blushed crimson. Lydia thought, "Why, he's shy." He transferred his dripping glass from his right hand to his left, so that he was unable to shake with either, and he stood there looking helpless. It was an awkward moment, for he needed to compose himself before he could greet Charlotte, but he was clearly waiting to greet her before he would compose himself. Lydia was about to make some inane remark just to fill the silence when Charlotte took over. She pulled the silk handkerchief from Alex's breast pocket and wiped his right hand with it, saying, "How do you do, Alexey Andreevich?" in Russian. She shook his now dry right hand, took the glass from his left hand, wiped the glass, wiped the left hand, gave him back the glass, stuffed the handkerchief back into his pocket, and made him sit down.
She sat beside him and said, "Now that you've finished throwing the sherry around, tell me about Diaghilev. He's supposed to be a strange man. Have you met him?"
Alex smiled. "Yes, I've met him." As Alex talked, Lydia marvelled. Charlotte had dealt with the awkward moment without hesitation, and had gone on to ask a question, one which she had presumably prepared in advance, which succeeded in taking Orlov's mind off himself and making him feel at ease. And she had done all that as smoothly as if she had had 20 years' practice. Where had she learned such poise? Lydia caught her husband's eye. He too had noted Charlotte's graciousness, and he was smiling from ear to ear in a glow of fatherly pride. Felix paced up and down in St. James's Park, pondering what he had seen. From time to time he glanced across the road at the graceful white façade of Walden's house, rising over the high forecourt wall like a noble head above a starched collar. He thought, "They believe they are safe in there." He sat on a bench in a position from which he could still see the house. Middle-class London swarmed about him, the girls in their outrageous headgear, the clerks and shopkeepers walking homeward in their dark suits and bowler hats. This book is continued on cassette number 2. The Man from St. Petersburg by Ken Follett. Continued. Middle-class London swarmed about him, the girls in their outrageous headgear, the clerks and shopkeepers walking homeward in their dark suits and bowler hats. There were gossiping nannies with babies in perambulators or overdressed toddlers. There were top-hatted gentlemen on their way to and from the clubs of St. James's. There were liveried footmen walking tiny, ugly dogs. A fat woman with a big bag of shopping plumped herself down on the bench beside him and said, "Hot enough for you?" He was not sure what would be the appropriate reply, so he smiled and looked away. It seemed that Orlov had realized his life might be in danger in England. He had shown himself for only a few seconds at the station, and not at all at the house. Felix guessed that he had requested in advance that he be met by a closed coach, for the weather was fine and most people were driving open landaus. Until today this killing had been planned in the abstract, Felix reflected. It had been a matter of international politics, diplomatic quarrels, alliances and ententes, military possibilities, the hypothetical reactions of faraway kaisers and czars. Now suddenly it was flesh and blood. It was a real man, of a certain size and shape. It was a youthful face with a small moustache, a face which must be smashed by a bullet. It was a short body in a heavy coat, which must be turned into blood and rags by a bomb. It was a clean-shaven throat above a spotted tie, a throat which must be sliced open to gush blood. Felix felt completely capable of doing it. More than that, he was eager. There were questions, they would be answered. There were problems, they would be solved. It would take nerve. He had plenty. He visualized Orlov and Walden inside that beautiful house, in their fine, soft clothes, surrounded by quiet servants. Soon they would have dinner at a long table, whose polished surface reflected like a mirror the crisp linen and silver cutlery. They would eat with perfectly clean hands, even the fingernails white, and the women wearing gloves. They would consume a tenth of the food provided and send the rest back to the kitchen. They might talk of racehorses, or the new ladies' fashions, or a king they all knew. Meanwhile, the people who were to fight the war shivered in hovels in the cruel Russian climate, yet could still find an extra bowl of potato soup for an itinerant anarchist. "What a joy it will be to kill Orlov," he thought. "What sweet revenge. When I have done that, I can die satisfied." He shivered. "You're catching a cold," said the fat woman. Felix shrugged. "I've got him a nice lamb chop for his dinner, and I've made an apple pie," she said. "Ah," said Felix. What on earth was she talking about? He got up from the bench and walked across the grass toward the house. He sat on the ground with his back to a tree. He would have to observe this house for a day or two and find out what kind of life Orloff would lead in London, when he would go out and to where, how he would travel, coach, landau, motor car or cab, how much time he would spend with Walden. Ideally, he wanted to be able to predict Orloff's movements and so lie in wait for him. He might achieve that simply by learning his habits. Otherwise, he would have to find a way of discovering the prince's plans in advance, perhaps by bribing a servant in the house. Then there was the question of what weapon to use and how to get it. The choice of weapon would depend upon the detailed circumstances of the killing. Getting it would depend on the Jubilee Street anarchists. For this purpose, the amateur dramatics group could be ignored, as could the Dunstan House's intellectuals, and indeed all those with visible means of support. But there were four or five angry young men who always had money for drinks, and, on the rare occasions when they talked politics, spoke of anarchism in terms of expropriating the expropriators, which was jargon for financing the revolution by theft. They would have weapons, or know where to get them. Two young girls who looked like shop assistants strolled by his tree, and he heard one of them say, "Told him, if you think just because you take a girl to the bioscope and buy her a glass of brown ale, you can—" Then they were past. A peculiar feeling came over Felix. He wondered whether the girls had caused it, but no, they meant nothing to him. "Am I apprehensive?" he thought. "No."
"Fulfilled?"
"No, that comes later."
"Excited?"
"Hardly." He finally figured out that he was happy. It was very odd indeed. That night Walden went to Lydia's room. After they had made love, she slept, and he lay in the dark with her head on his shoulder, remembering St. Petersburg in 1895. He was always travelling in those days, America, Africa, Arabia, mainly because England was not big enough for him and his father both. He found St. Petersburg society gay but prim. He liked the Russian landscape and the vodka. Languages came easily to him, but Russian was the most difficult he had ever encountered, and he enjoyed the challenge. As the heir to an earldom, Stephen was obliged to pay a courtesy call on the British ambassador, and the ambassador in his turn was expected to invite Stephen to parties and introduce him around. Stephen went to the parties because he liked talking politics with diplomats almost as much as he liked gambling with officers and getting drunk with actresses. It was at a reception in the British embassy that he first met Lydia. He had heard of her previously. She was spoken of as a paragon of virtue and a great beauty. She was beautiful, in a frail, colourless sort of way, with pale skin, pale blonde hair, and a white gown. She was also modest, respectable, and scrupulously polite. There seemed to be nothing to her, and Stephen detached himself from her company quite quickly. But later he found himself seated next to her at dinner, and he was obliged to converse with her. The Russians all spoke French, and if they learned a third language it was German, so Lydia had very little English. Fortunately, Stephen's French was good. Finding something to talk about was a bigger problem. He said something about the government of Russia, and she replied with the reactionary platitudes that were two a penny at the time. He spoke about his enthusiasm, big game hunting in Africa, and she was interested for a while until he mentioned the naked black pygmies, at which point she blushed and turned away to talk with the man on her other side. Stephen told himself he was not very interested in her, for she was the kind of girl one married, and he was not planning to marry. Still, she left him with the nagging feeling that there was more to her than met the eye. Lying in bed with her 19 years later, Walden thought, "She still gives me that nagging feeling," and he smiled ruefully in the dark. He had seen her once more that evening in St. Petersburg. After dinner, he had lost his way in the labyrinthine embassy building and had wandered into the music room. She was there alone, sitting at the piano, filling the room with wild, passionate music. The tune was unfamiliar and almost discordant, but it was Lydia who fascinated Stephen. The pale, untouchable beauty was gone. Her eyes flashed, her head tossed, her body trembled with emotion, and she seemed altogether a different woman. He never forgot that music. Later he discovered that it had been Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto in B-flat minor, and since then he went to hear it played at every opportunity, although he never told Lydia why. When he left the embassy, he went back to his hotel to change his clothes, for he had an appointment to play cards at midnight. He was a keen gambler, but not a self-destructive one. He knew how much he could afford to lose, and when he had lost it, he stopped playing. Had he run up enormous debts, he would have been obliged to ask his father to pay them, and that he could not bear to do. Sometimes he won quite large sums. However, that was not the appeal of gambling for him. He liked the masculine companionship, the drinking, and the late hours. He did not keep that midnight rendezvous. Pritchard, his valet, was tying Stephen's tie when the British ambassador knocked on the door of the hotel suite. His Excellency looked as if he had got out of bed and dressed hastily. Stephen's first thought was that some kind of revolution was going on, and all the British would have to take refuge in the embassy.
"Bad news, I'm afraid," said the ambassador. "You'd better sit down. Cable from England. It's your father."
The old tyrant was dead of a heart attack at 65. "Well, I'm damned," Stephen said. "So soon."
"My deepest sympathy,"
the ambassador said. "It was very good of you to come personally."
"Not at all. Anything I can do?"
"You're very kind." The ambassador shook his hand and left. Walden stared into space, thinking about the old man. He had been immensely tall, with a will of iron, and a sour disposition. His sarcasm could bring tears to your eyes. There were three ways to deal with him. You could become like him, you could go under, or you could go away. Stephen's mother, a sweet, helpless Victorian girl, had gone under and died young. Stephen had gone away. He pictured his father lying in a coffin and thought, "You're helpless at last. Now you can't make housemaids cry, or footmen tremble, or children run and hide. You're powerless to arrange marriages, evict tenants, or defeat parliamentary bills. You'll send no more thieves to jail, transport no more agitators to Australia. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust." In later years he revised his opinion of his father. Now, in 1914, at the age of 50, Walden could admit to himself that he had inherited some of his father's values: love of knowledge, a belief in rationalism, a commitment to good work as the justification of a man's existence. But back in 1895 there had been only bitterness. Pritchard brought a bottle of whiskey on a tray and said, "This is a sad day, my lord." That, my lord, startled Stephen. He and his brother had courtesy titles. Stephen's was Lord Highcombe, but they were always called Sir by the servants, and my lord was reserved for their father. Now, of course, Stephen was the Earl of Walden. Along with the title, he now possessed several thousands of acres in the south of England, a big chunk of Scotland, 6 racehorses, Walden Hall, a villa in Monte Carlo, a shooting box in Scotland, and a seat in the House of Lords. He would have to live at Walden Hall. It was the family seat, and the Earl always lived there. He would put in electric light, he decided. He would sell some of the farms and invest in London property and North American railroads. He would make his maiden speech in the House of Lords. What would he speak on? Foreign policy, probably. There were tenants to be looked after, several households to be managed. He would have to appear in court in the season and give shooting parties and hunt balls. He needed a wife. The role of Earl of Walden could not be played by a bachelor. Someone must be hostess at all those parties. Someone must reply to invitations, discuss menus with cooks, allocate bedrooms to guests, and sit at the foot of the long table in the dining room of Walden Hall. There must be a Countess of Walden. There must be an heir.
"I need a wife, Pritchard."
"Yes, my lord. Our bachelor days are over."
The next day Walden saw Lydia's father and formally asked permission to call on her. 20 years later he found it difficult to imagine how he could have been so wickedly irresponsible, even in his youth. He had never asked himself whether she was the right wife for him, only whether she was good countess material. He had never wondered whether he could make her happy. He had assumed that the hidden passion released when she played the piano would be released for him, and he had been wrong. He called on her every day for 2 weeks. There was no possibility of getting home in time for his father's funeral, and then he proposed, not to her, but to her father. Her father saw the match in the same practical terms as Walden. Walden explained that he wanted to marry immediately, although he was in mourning, because he had to get home and manage the estate. Lydia's father understood perfectly. They were married 6 weeks later. What an arrogant young fool I was, he thought. I imagined that England would always rule the world, and I would always rule my own heart. The moon came out from behind a cloud and illuminated the bedroom. He looked down at Lydia's sleeping face. I didn't foresee this, he thought. I didn't know that I would fall helplessly, hopelessly in love with you. I asked only that we should like each other, and in the end, that was enough for you, but not for me. I never thought that I would need your smile, yearn for your kisses, long for you to come to my room at night. I never thought that I would be frightened, terrified of losing you. She murmured in her sleep and turned over. He pulled his arm from under her neck, then sat up on the edge of the bed. If he stayed any longer, he would nod off, and it would not do to have Lydia's maid catch them in bed together when she came in with the morning cup of tea. He put on his dressing gown and his carpet slippers and walked softly out of the room, through the twin dressing rooms and into his own bedroom. I'm such a lucky man, he thought, as he lay down to sleep. Walden surveyed the breakfast table. There were pots of coffee, China tea and Indian tea, jugs of cream, milk and cordial, a big bowl of hot porridge, plates of scones and toast, and little pots of marmalade, honey, and jam. On the sideboard was a row of silver dishes, each warmed by its own spirit lamp, containing scrambled eggs, sausages, bacon, kidneys, and haddock. On the cold table were pressed beef, ham, and tongue. The fruit bowl on a table of its own was piled with nectarines, oranges, melons, and strawberries. This ought to put Alex in a good mood, he thought. He helped himself to eggs and kidneys and sat down. The Russians would have their price, he thought. They would want something in return for their promise of military help. He was worried about what the price might be. If they were to ask for something England could not possibly grant, the whole deal would collapse immediately, and then it was his job to make sure it did not collapse. He would have to manipulate Alex. The thought made him uncomfortable. Having known the boy for so long should have been a help, but in fact it might have been easier to negotiate in a tough way with someone about whom one did not care personally. I must put my feelings aside, he thought. We must have Russia. He poured coffee and took some scones and honey. A minute later, Alex came in looking bright-eyed and well-scrubbed. Sleep well? Walden asked him. Wonderfully well. Alex took a nectarine and began to eat it with a knife and fork. Is that all you're having? Walden said. You used to love English breakfast. I remember you eating porridge, cream, eggs, beef, and strawberries, and then asking cook for more toast. I'm not a growing boy any more, Uncle Stephen. I might do well to remember that, Walden thought. After breakfast, they went into the morning room. Our new 5-year plan for the Army and Navy is about to be announced, Alex said. That's what he does, Walden thought. He tells you something before he asks you for something. He remembered Alex saying, I'm planning to read Clausewitz this summer, Uncle. By the way, may I bring a guest to Scotland for the shooting? The budget for the next 5 years is 7.5 billion rubles, Alex went on. At 10 rubles to the pound sterling, Walden calculated, that made £750 million. It's a massive program, he said, but I wish you had begun it 5 years ago.
So do I, said Alex.
The chances are that the program will hardly have started before we're at war. Alex shrugged. Walden thought, he won't commit himself to a forecast of how soon Russia might be at war, of course. The first thing you should do is increase the size of the guns on your dreadnoughts. Alex shook his head.
Our third dreadnought is about to be launched. The fourth is being built now. Both will have 12-inch guns.
It's not enough, Alex. Churchill has gone over to 15-inch guns for ours.
And he's right. Our commanders know that, but our politicians don't. You know Russia, Uncle. New ideas are viewed with the utmost distrust. Innovation takes forever.
We're fencing, Walden thought.
What is your priority? 100 million rubles will be spent immediately on the Black Sea Fleet.
I should have thought the North Sea was more important. For England, anyway.
We have a more Asian viewpoint than you. Our bullying neighbor is Turkey, not Germany.
They might be allies.
They might indeed, Alex hesitated. The great weakness of the Russian Navy, he went on,
is that we have no warm water port.
It sounded like the beginning of a prepared speech. This is it, Walden thought. We're getting to the heart of the matter now. But he continued to fence.
What about Odessa? On the Black Sea coast, while the Turks hold Constantinople and Gallipoli, they control the passage between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. So, for strategic purposes, the Black Sea might as well be an inland lake.
Which is why the Russian Empire has been trying to push southward for hundreds of years.
Why not? We're Slavs, and many of the Balkan peoples are Slavs. If they want national freedom, of course we sympathize.
Indeed. Still, if they get it, they will probably let your navy pass freely into the Mediterranean.
Slav control of the Balkans would help us. Russian control would help even more.
No doubt, although it's not on the cards as far as I can see.
Would you like to give the matter some thought?
Walden opened his mouth to speak, then closed it abruptly.
This is it, he thought. This is what they want. This is the price. We can't give Russia the Balkans, for God's sakes.
If the deal depends on that, there will be no deal.
Alex was saying, if we are to fight alongside you, we must be strong. The area we are talking about is the area in which we need strengthening, so naturally we look to you for help there.
That was putting it as plainly as could be. Give us the Balkans and we'll fight with you. Pulling himself together, Walden frowned as if puzzled and said,
if Britain had control of the Balkans, we could, at least in theory, give the area to you. But we can't give you what we haven't got, so I'm not sure how we can strengthen you, as you put it, in that area.
Alex's reply was so quick that it must have been rehearsed.
But you might acknowledge the Balkans as a Russian sphere of influence.
Ah, that's not so bad, Walden thought. That we might be able to manage. He was enormously relieved. He decided to test Alex's determination before winding up the discussion. He said,
we could certainly agree to favour you over Austria or Turkey in that part of the world.
Alex shook his head.
We want more than that, he said firmly.
It had been worth a try. Alex was young and shy, but he could not be pushed around. Worse luck. Walden needed time to reflect now. For Britain to do as Russia wanted would mean a significant shift in international alignments, and such shifts, like movements of the Earth's crust, caused earthquakes in unexpected places.
You may like to talk with Churchill before we go any farther, Alex said with a little smile.
You know damn well I will, Walden thought. He realized suddenly how well Alex had handled the whole thing. First he had scared Walden with a completely outrageous demand, then, when he put forward his real demand, Walden had been so relieved that he welcomed it. I thought I was going to manipulate Alex, but in the event, he manipulated me. Walden smiled.
I'm proud of you, my boy, he said.
That morning, Felix figured out when, where, and how he was going to kill Prince Orlov. The plan began to take shape in his mind while he read the Times in the library of the Jubilee Street Club. His imagination was sparked by a paragraph in the court circular column. Prince Alexei Andreevich Orlov arrived from St. Petersburg yesterday. He is to be the guest of the Earl and Countess of Walden for the London season. Prince Orlov will be presented to their Majesties the King and Queen at the court on Thursday, June the 4th. Now he knew for certain that Orlov would be at a certain place on a certain date at a certain time. Information of this kind was essential to a carefully planned assassination. Felix had anticipated that he would get the information either by speaking to one of Walden's servants or by observing Orlov and identifying some habitual rendezvous. Now he had no need to take the risks involved in interviewing servants or trailing people. He wondered whether Orlov knew that his movements were being advertised by the newspapers as if for the benefit of assassins. It was typically English, he thought. The next problem was how to get sufficiently close to Orlov to kill him. Even Felix would have difficulty getting into a royal palace. But this question also was answered by the Times. On the same page as the court circular, sandwiched between a report of a dance given by Lady Bailey and the details of the latest wills, he read, The King's Court. Arrangements for carriages. In order to facilitate the arrangements for calling the carriages of the company at their Majesty's courts at Buckingham Palace,
we are requested to state that in the case of the company having the privilege of the entree at the Pimlico entrance, the coachman of each carriage returning to take up is required to leave with the constable stationed on the left of the gateway a card distinctly written with the name of the lady or gentleman to whom the carriage belongs, and, in the case of the carriages of the general company returning to take up at the general entrance, a similar card should be handed to the constable stationed on the left of the archway leading to the quadrangle of the palace. To enable the company to receive the advantage of the above arrangements, it is necessary that a footman should accompany each carriage, as no provision can be made for calling the carriages beyond giving the names to the footman waiting at the door with whom it rests to bring the carriage. The doors will be open for the reception of the company at 8:30 o'clock. Felix read it several times. There was something about the prose style of the times that made it extremely difficult to comprehend. It seemed at least to mean that as people left the palace, their footmen were sent running to fetch their carriages, which would be parked somewhere else. There must be a way, he thought, that I can contrive to be in or on the Walden carriage when it returns to the palace to pick them up. One major difficulty remained. He had no gun. He could have got one easily enough in Geneva, but then to have carried it across international frontiers would have been risky. He might have been refused entry into England if his baggage had been searched. It was surely just as easy to get a gun in London, but he did not know how, and he was most reluctant to make open inquiries. He had observed gun shops in the West End of London, and noted that all the customers who went in and out looked thoroughly upper class. Felix would not get served in there, even if he had the money to buy their beautifully made precision firearms. He had spent time in low-class pubs where guns were surely bought and sold among criminals, but he had not seen it happen, which was hardly surprising. His only hope was the anarchists. He had got into conversation with those of them whom he thought serious, but they never talked of weapons, doubtless because of Felix's presence. The trouble was that he had not been around long enough to be trusted. There were always police spies in anarchist groups, and while this did not prevent the anarchists from welcoming newcomers, it made them wary. Now the time for surreptitious investigation had run out. He would have to ask directly how guns were to be obtained. It would require careful handling. And immediately afterward, he would have to sever his ties with Jubilee Street and move to another part of London to avoid the risk of being traced. He considered the young Jewish tearaways of Jubilee Street. They were angry and violent boys. Unlike their parents, they refused to work like slaves in the sweatshops of the East End, sewing the suits that the aristocracy ordered from Savile Row tailors. Unlike their parents, they paid no attention to the conservative sermonizing of the rabbis. But as yet, they had not decided whether the solutions to their problems lay in politics or in crime. His best prospect, he decided, was Nathan Sabolinsky. A man of about 20, he had rather Slavic good looks and wore very high stiff collars and a yellow waistcoat. Felix had seen him around the Spielers off the Commercial Road. He must have had money to spend on gambling as well as on clothes. He looked around the library. The other occupants were an old man asleep, a woman in a heavy coat reading Das Kapital in German and making notes, and a Lithuanian Jew bent over a Russian newspaper reading with the aid of a magnifying glass. Felix left the room and went downstairs. There was no sign of Nathan or any of his friends. It was a little early for him. If he worked at all, Felix thought, he worked at night. Felix went back to Dunstan House's. He packed his razor, his clean underwear, and his spare shirt in his cardboard suitcase. He told Millie, Rudolf Rocker's wife, "I've found a room. I'll come back this evening to say thank you to Rudolf." He strapped the suitcase to the back seat of the bicycle and rode west to central London, then north to Camden Town. Here he found a street of high, once grand houses, which had been built for pretentious middle-class families who had now moved to the suburbs at the ends of the new railway lines. In one of them Felix rented a dingy room from an Irish woman called Bridget. He paid her 10 shillings in advance of 2 weeks' rent. By midday he was back in Stepney, outside Nathan's home in Sydney Street. It was a small row house of the two rooms up and two down type. The front door was wide open. Felix walked in. The noise and the smell hit him like a blow. There, in a room about 12 feet square, some 15 or 20 people were working at tailoring. Men were using machines,
Women were sewing by hand, and children were pressing finished garments. Steam rose from the ironing boards to mingle with the smell of sweat. The machines clattered, the irons hissed, and the workers jabbered incessantly in Yiddish. Pieces of cloth cut ready for stitching were piled on every available patch of floor space. Nobody looked up at Felix. They were all working furiously fast. He spoke to the nearest person, a girl with a baby at her breast. She was hand-sewing buttons onto the sleeve of a jacket.
"Is Nathan here?" he said.
"Upstairs," she said, without pausing in her work. Felix went out of the room and up the narrow staircase. Each of the two small bedrooms had four beds. Most of them were occupied, presumably, by people who worked at night. He found Nathan in the back room, sitting on the edge of a bed, buttoning his shirt. Nathan saw him and said,
"Felix, wie geht's?"
"I need to talk to you," Felix said in Yiddish.
"So talk. Come outside."
Nathan put on his coat and they went out into Sydney Street. They stood in the sunshine, close to the open window of the sweatshop, their conversation masked by the noise from inside.
"My father's trade," said Nathan. "He'll pay a girl fivepence for machining a pair of trousers, an hour's work for her. He'll pay another threepence to the girls who cut breasts and sew on buttons. Then he will take the trousers to a West End tailor and get paid ninepence. Profit one penny, enough to buy one slice of bread. If he asks the West End tailor for tenpence, he'll be thrown out of the shop, and the work will be given to one of the dozens of Jewish tailors out in the street with their machines under their arms. I won't live like that."
"Is this why you're an anarchist? Those people make the most beautiful clothes in the world, but did you see how they are dressed? And how will things be changed? By violence?"
"I think so.
I was sure you would feel this way."
"Nathan, I need a gun."
Nathan laughed nervously.
"What for?
Why do anarchists usually want guns?"
"You tell me, Felix."
"To steal from thieves, to oppress tyrants, and to kill murderers."
"Which are you going to do?"
"I'll tell you, if you really want to know." Nathan thought for a moment, then said, "Go to the Frying Pan pub on the corner of Brick Lane and Thrall Street. See Garfield the Dwarf."
"Thank you," said Felix, unable to keep the note of triumph out of his voice. "How much will I have to pay?"
5 shillings for a pinfire."
"I'd rather have something more reliable."
"Good guns are expensive."
"I'll just have to haggle."
Felix shook Nathan's hand.
"Thank you."
Nathan watched him climb on his bicycle.
"Maybe you'll tell me about it afterward."
Felix smiled.
"You'll read about it in the papers."
He waved a hand and rode off. He cycled along Whitechapel Road and Whitechapel High Street, then turned right into Osborne Street. Immediately the character of the streets changed. This was the most run-down part of London he had yet seen. The streets were narrow and very dirty, the air smoky and noisome, the people mostly wretched. The gutters were choked with filth. But despite all that, the place was as busy as a beehive. Men ran up and down with hand-carts, crowds gathered around street stalls, prostitutes worked every corner, and the workshops of carpenters and bootmakers spilled out onto the pavements. Felix left his bicycle outside the door of the Frying Pan. If it was taken, he would just have to steal another one. To enter the pub, he had to step over what looked like a dead cat. Inside was a single room, low and bare, with a bar at the far end. Older men and women sat on benches around the walls, while younger people stood in the middle of the room. Felix went to the bar and asked for a glass of ale and a cold sausage. He looked around and spotted Garfield the Dwarf. He had not seen him before because the man was standing on a chair. He was about 4 feet tall, with a large head and a middle-aged face. A very big black dog sat on the floor beside his chair. He was talking to two large, tough-looking men dressed in leather waistcoats and collarless shirts. Perhaps they were bodyguards. Felix noted their large bellies and grinned to himself, thinking, "I'll eat them up alive." The two men held quart pots of ale, but the dwarf was drinking what looked like gin. The barman handed Felix his drink and his sausage. "And a glass of the best gin," Felix said. A young woman at the bar looked at him and said, "Is that for me?" She smiled coquettishly, showing rotten teeth. Felix looked away. When the gin came, he paid and walked over to the group, who were standing near a small window which looked onto the street. Felix stood between them and the door. He addressed the dwarf.
"Mr. Garfield,
Who wants him?
Said Garfield in a squeaky voice. Felix offered the glass of gin. May I speak to you about business? Garfield took the glass, drained it, and said,
No.
Felix sipped his ale. It was sweeter and less fizzy than Swiss beer. He said, I wish to buy a gun.
I don't know what you've come here for, then.
I heard about you at the Jubilee Street Club.
Anarchist, are you?
Felix said nothing. Garfield looked him up and down.
What kind of gun would you want, if I had any?
A revolver. A good one.
Something like a Browning 7-shot?
That would be perfect.
I haven't got one.